The message you are about to hear was inspired by the tragic disaster that struck Southern Asia on December 26, 2004. It was delivered by Dennis Fisher, a longtime member of God's Church and the author of numerous articles on God's work and His plan for mankind. And now, Dennis Fisher.
Brethren, on December 26, 2004, Southern Asia was hit with a massive tsunami stemming from a 9.0 earthquake in the Indian Ocean. When the force of this act of nature's fury was finally unleashed, it absolutely devastated what was once one of the most tranquil regions in the entire world. Every day, the death toll of this tragedy continues to soar, with some experts predicting that it could eclipse 400,000 lives. Imagine the heartache. Currently, over 150,000 are counted among the casualties, including 50,000 children. When visiting the area, U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell said, and I quote, "I have never seen anything like it." Yehuda Meshi Zahav, a leader of one of the rescue teams in Thailand, described the scene this way, and I quote, "Only during the great flood of Genesis has there been sights like this. So many corpses, so many. We are experiencing something from the days of Genesis." As a result of this catastrophe, a massive relief effort has begun around the world. President George W. Bush has even enlisted the support of two prior presidents, George H.W. Bush and William Jefferson Clinton, to head up fundraising efforts in the United States. The financial impact of this tragedy is simply monumental and is currently estimated at multiple billions of dollars. However, the cost of shattered lives is truly incalculable. As relief workers try to sort through thousands of tons of wreckage, millions of people in all parts of the globe are now wondering why such a horrible tragedy had to happen. It simply doesn't make sense, especially if there is a loving God. So now the questions are starting to be posed. Why would an all-powerful God allow such destruction? Why would He consent to innocent children being literally swept from their mother's arms and whisked to a torturous death? Why would He permit the shattering of lives, especially the lives of such a peaceable people? To many, these questions seem unanswerable, something beyond mankind's ability to grasp. Often they are explained by the believers in the world as just one of life's great mysteries. How many times are we going to hear this? God works in mysterious ways. Or we just have to have faith in things that we cannot understand. Now, meanwhile, those who do not believe in a higher power often seize upon events like this to advance another conclusion. They contend that natural disasters, as well as a host of other evils like disease, poverty, crime, and injustice, stand as proof that God is either impotent or He is evil. Absent those possibilities, he must be nothing more than a figment of people's imagination, a myth perpetrated on the gullible. Now, as Mr. Bradick mentioned to you, I'm involved in a work that is really committed to taking a very serious message to the world and to the church. It is really in its infant stages. But even now, we have gotten responses from people that have challenged the things that we believe, our notions about who God is, how He works. We received a letter from somebody. I'd like to read the letter because it addresses the issue, and I believe it was inspired by this horrible natural catastrophe that happened in Southeast Asia. And he is seizing upon this to almost mock anybody that would believe in God. In other words, if there is an all-powerful God, how in the world could He let this happen? By the way, I saw a television show on cable, and there was an atheist that kept mocking God and called Him a thug and a punk, and no loving God would ever allow something like this to happen. And he was mocking Him, daring God, strike me dead, let's see if you're really around, and this type of thing. And you're going to see, you know, a host of cynics say, well now, where is your God? I know you're going to get really philosophical on this, but you tell me where that God is when people suffer so greatly. your loving God, your all-powerful God. All-powerful, He couldn't snuff out a storm. Instead, He allowed hundreds of thousands of lives to just be wiped out. Here is the letter that He wrote to us, to whom it may concern. So now that Indonesia has suffered the worst natural disaster in decades, all the mindless double talk begins. I just love listening to people like you try to defend God at times like this. Throughout the letter, God is always lowercase, by the way. At times like this, you have more nerve than a wizard in the Dark Ages. At least the wizard was conjuring up something you can see. You and other Christians of your ilk create your potion of lies out of nothing. I'm just amazed that anyone with an ounce of gray matter would fall for anything you men of the cloth would say. I'm sure you think you have an answer for everything in life, but I'd like you to see you try your hand at some of the questions that have been bothering me lately. He then identifies 10 questions. I'd like to read them to you. Question number 1, why does a loving God allow children to get cancer? Go visit St. Jude's Hospital if you want to see all the suffering they go through. Good question. Question 2, why does the Almighty permit AIDS to consume its victims? Oh yeah, I forgot. He's sending it to rid the world of faggots. That's question 2. Question 3, why does your loving God allow people to starve to death in underdeveloped nations? There's a good question. Question 4, why does He permit war? Question 5, why does this just God of yours allow racism and bigotry? How do these things fit into His divine plan? Question number 6, why does God allow children to be molested? Where was He when Catholic priests were raping? That's right, they were raping choir boys in their parishes. Is it a pretty good question? Question number 7, why does God allow all the filth and squalor in the world? Question number 8, why all the murder? Why all the death? What is His thing with death anyway? Question number 9, why does your God allow people to be destroyed by earthquakes, hurricanes, tornadoes, tidal waves, and tsunamis? Why doesn't He just rain down fire and finish the job, whatever that job might be? Question number 10, finally, if God is so loving and so powerful, why doesn't He do something to prevent all the suffering? Or is it that He just doesn't care? Brethren, I have some news for you. The writer of this letter poses some very interesting questions. And despite the fact that so many people, including professing Christians today, despite the fact that they struggle with making sense out of tragedy, there is an answer, a real answer. And furthermore, that answer is clear and direct. It is not some theological mumbo-jumbo, and it is most definitely not some mindless double talk. This might come as a surprise to many in the world when you look at the world and the state of affairs today, but the God of the Bible hates human suffering. That's right, He hates it. God hates suffering. Furthermore, the Scriptures make it absolutely clear that the time is going to come when the suffering is going to end, when His will and His way will be the law of the land. And when I say the land, the entirety of the earth, and there will be peace and prosperity and health and hope will just radiate throughout that planet. The Bible reveals that when Jesus Christ returns to this earth, He will establish a kingdom whose laws will be so perfect they will fill the entire earth with everything that is right. Imagine that. It will be a kingdom in which sight will be restored to the blind and strength will be restored to the lame. Furthermore, the entire earth, according to the Scriptures, are going to be like a garden paradise. When describing this kingdom, the great prophet Isaiah proclaimed that when it comes, God Himself will wipe away all tears. He went on to say that at that time, sorrow and sighing will actually take flight, never to return again. Imagine what a wonderful place this will be. Imagine a world where you will never, ever, ever hear the sounds of grief and anguish. Imagine never having to witness the torment of fathers and mothers searching for children that, yes, were ripped from their arms and whisked to their death. Imagine a place where hospitals are unnecessary and food banks are irrelevant. Imagine a place where hope is everywhere, and despair is only a distant memory. Brethren, that place is real. And the great God of hope has given us His immutable promise that it is going to come. Furthermore, it is going to be presided over by a great deliverer, a wonderful God King. In this kingdom, there will be no more international conflicts. In this kingdom, there will be no acts of terrorism. In this kingdom, there will be no political corruption or corporate scandals. Brethren, the streets in this kingdom will always be safe, and children will be able to walk into the homes of strangers and be treated like family. It is a time when all people will worship the same God and have the same laws. Suffice it to say, it is a world that is radically different than the one we live in today. With this said, brethren, many may wonder why a God who hates human suffering so much would allow it to happen in such a great way. In other words, if God is so committed to making mankind to live in a world of great peace, prosperity, great health, great hope, and everything that is right, why wouldn't He have intervened to prevent a catastrophic killer such as that which took place 2 weeks ago today? These are fair questions, and they are asked by cynic and believer alike, but they are fair questions. And brethren, I want you to prepare yourself for a real shocking answer, one that this world may reject but is nevertheless true. And in the course of this message, I am going to prove this. The reason God doesn't intervene in natural disasters, brethren, is because mankind does not want Him to. As shocking as this might sound, because you hear everybody saying, you know, God, and they're crying out to Him, they really don't want Him to do it. They want Him to butt out of their business. And the story of human history bears this out. And they do so despite the fact that God often does intervene, actually does speak to His people, suggesting, would you like me to help you in this? There is a formula for this. I can assist you in this. And despite this fact, mankind goes, no, I will do it myself. I can fix this. Somehow I can craft laws that will make our lives better. I can forge governments that will make the world safer. I can do all of this thing. I can create cultures. I can inspire values and inspire faith. And I know that is all I need is just one more at bat here, one more chance to do this, and everything is going to be right. And in essence, what God does is, I'll stand down. I'll just stand over here and watch you do it. And periodically He will say, would you like my help? No, I'll just stand over here. And the story of the human experience cries this out. I want you to imagine something because I want to describe this story. Let's make a couple of assumptions. And it's fair, it's reasonable to make assumptions. Let's assume that God really exists. Okay, I think that's probably not a hard assumption to persuade people in this room, but we've got to make the assumption, God exists. Now let's assume that the God of the Bible is the true God. He's the one that exists. Okay, now assumption three, He is all powerful. He can do anything. He can fashion the universe. He can declare, what does it say in Isaiah 46, 9 and 10? I am God and there is none else. I am God and there is none like me, declaring the end from the beginning and the former things from those that have not yet taken place, saying, my counsel shall stand and I will do all my good pleasure. I am the God that actually tells you, this is what happened here and here's what's going to happen there. And although it hasn't happened and you may be the biggest doubter in the world, you watch. I will do all my good pleasure. I will make the biggest mess turn into the greatest victory. I will pull this off. And despite the fact that you may think that I am impotent, that I'm some kind of bully in the sky that just likes to push around the little people, I will pull this off. Assume for a moment that that is the God. Now assume that this God is such an extraordinary architect that when He plans things out, He actually does it in such a way that there is such uncanny detail and precision to the plan that if you do what He tells you to do, you will live a life of prosperity and abundance and everything. So imagine there's this exquisite planet that's, you know, set in the midst of this infinite universe. And God now fashions this beautiful garden, and He sets two people in the garden. And He's now going to tell these two people, you know, and it may be a conversation like this. So, what do you think? Wow, this is really cool. This looks beautiful and all of that. Well, I'd like to give you an opportunity to be the one who decides the destiny of mankind and how this is going to play out. Would you like to do this? And they may think about it. Well, does it involve a lot of stuff? Oh, yeah, it does. But I've got some good news. I have already created a formula that if you follow will result in human happiness just being strewn all over the planet. Everything will thrive. Everything will be successful. It will be a wonderful place. But you must follow the formula. So what I have for you, I've placed before you these two trees. The tree on the left we'll call the tree of life. And if you partake of that tree, that's the formula for human happiness, for human success, for everything to go right. Because that tree will be tethered to me. And when you partake of this fruit, you literally are going to partake of my wisdom, my virtue, my justice, my righteousness, my character, everything that is me. And as you navigate your path through this life, you will know how I think. And you can navigate your path according to that. There is another tree over here. We're going to set this here. This is called the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Now you may eat that. And what that will enable you to do is to do everything your way. So you don't have to call on me for wisdom, virtue, righteousness, character, that type of thing. You do not have to rely on my formula. You can do it your way. You cannot do it both ways. So if you want my tree, you must reject this tree. If you want this tree, you must reject my tree. It's none of this and gobble it up. Using me as the great moral presence in your life that will guide and direct you, that's here. Relying on your own self-determinant will to do things the way you want, that's here. Here, happiness and everything. And I'm telling you because I created the planet. I created all the laws that sustain it. Not only the physical laws that sustain the planet and the universe, but the moral laws that drive happiness. See, mankind will always be good at building things and doing the physical stuff. Okay, mankind has the smarts to build the car. Unfortunately, he lacks the virtue that causes him to build the tank, build the bomb, and build everything else. Here, he'll have the virtue, not only the technical wisdom to build a wonderful planet, but he will have the spiritual virtue to do things because they are right. That's the way it is. My way, your way. But you get to choose. And if you want, I'll leave and you can make the choice. And what man did is they chose self-determination. This is what they've done. Despite the fact that God warned them that they were not equipped to do it. It's kind of like, imagine God is a car manufacturer. So He makes this car and He tells you how the car is going to run. And you say, cool, it's a beautiful car. Leather interior, it has a nice sound system. Boy, it starts up right away. I love the way new cars start up. This is terrific. And you've got this instruction manual. Okay, it requires gasoline and stuff. Okay, I've got it. And this guy decides after the gas tank runs out to put chocolate milk in the gas tank. Okay, this is not going to be very effective. The car is not going to run. He's going to be kicking it and screaming at it and just going crazy. And he said, God, what kind of a lousy wreck of a car did you build? And he said, I don't understand. What's wrong? And he says, the car won't run. And he said, well, it's out of gas. What did you put in it? And he said, I put chocolate milk. Well, it doesn't use chocolate milk. It uses gasoline. I told you it used gasoline. What kind of a stupid car is this? Well, do you want me to kind of help you out and show you what you need to do with it? No, I'll take care of it myself. Now, brethren, if anybody has ever had children, this is very familiar to them. Okay, who in the world who has ever had kids, and I want you to imagine this beautiful living room that has this glass coffee table. Okay, I just want a survey here. How many would give your five-year-old kid in the living room a hammer? Okay, now you give him the hammer, he's going to what? Fix everything. This is what he does. I got a hammer. I can fix everything. And he's out knocking out windows, busting lamps, wrecking furniture, and you're out trying to get the hammer away from him. And is he surrendering it, saying, "Oh, wise one, you know more than I do"? No, he's holding onto the hammer. He thinks he can fix it. This is the story of man. He has the hammer. God says, "Would you like a little help?" And the man, "No, I can fix it myself." And he goes about just wrecking this world. How did it all come about? And quite frankly, a bigger question than this to this man is, where is it going to end? Because it certainly looks pretty bleak right now. I want to show you where the story really began. And I want you to go to Genesis chapter 3, if you will. Genesis chapter 3. Because armed with this knowledge regarding these two trees, God leaves the scene for a moment, and Adam and Eve are left in this palatial garden where everything is right. No environmental catastrophes, no tsunamis, hurricanes, tidal waves, pleasant weather, a beautiful place. It reflected God's handiwork. It had His signature on it. You can read the 104th Psalm, I believe, that talks about God renewing the face of the earth and what exquisite detail He did, even in preparing the food on the planet and things like this, and why He did it, that His heart was inclined toward the people that would reside on the planet, and He actually did things for their pleasure. He was considerate of everything. So now here they reside in this beautiful place. And in chapter 3, enters the quintessential embodiment of evil. And in this moment, brethren, we are going to watch evil and innocence collide. And it is going to be a bona fide train wreck. On one side, Eve, who is totally innocent. On the other side, the prince of darkness, the embodiment of everything that is wrong, the wrecker of hope and the destroyer of lies. And now he has set his sights on this woman. Verse 1, "Now the serpent was more subtle than any beast of the field which the eternal God had made. And he said unto the woman," and I want you to listen to this question. I don't know if you've ever thought of this. He says unto the woman, "Yea, has God said, you shall not eat of every tree of the garden?" This was the question. Has God said you can't eat of any tree in the garden? Now, he knew that wasn't true. I think everybody will agree with that. But did you know? He also knew that Eve knew it wasn't true. And literally, what I think he was trying to do was act a little dumb so he could empower Eve. I will let her think she is the authority. So I'm going to say something that is totally outrageous. She will know it's wrong, and she will correct me. I would liken it to something like this. There is a predator of children, and he drives by a neighborhood, and he gets out of the car, and he sees this little child, and he wants to entice this child to come toward him. So he asks a real kind of silly question. "I have a question, little girl. Now, do the police put out the fires and the firemen go and help people?" And the little girl goes, No. "The firemen put out the fires and the policemen go to help the people." Can you imagine this? Now this person becomes the expert. Okay? And, "Oh, yeah, you're right. Wow, you are so smart. You know, can I ask you another? Come here. I want to ask you about puppies. Do you know about puppies?" And literally has drawn this person into it. I believe this is what Satan was doing to Eve. Has God said that you can't eat of any of the trees of the garden? And notice what her response is. "And the woman said unto him, we may eat of the fruit of the trees of the garden, but it's the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden. God has said, you shall not eat of it, neither shall you touch it, lest you die. Now, she has corrected him by his consent. Now he goes on and says to her, you shall not surely die, for God knows that in the day you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you shall be as gods, knowing good and evil. Do you know what Satan was telling the woman? By doing this, by going contrary to God's law, by sinning, if you do this, I have news for you. Sin is empowering. It will make you like him. Obeying him is not empowering. This is disabling him. You be the judge of this. And he ultimately, I believe this is what he probably suggested. You know what, Eve? You can't trust God or me. I understand that. So why don't you be the judge? I mean, you're smart. You obviously know a lot about, you know, what was said. I mean, you know more than I do about what God said. That was an extremely good comment. So you are obviously smart enough to make this decision. Why don't you look at the tree? I mean, you're bright and articulate and stuff, and I'll just step over here. You know, use all your skills, all your talents, all your wisdom, and you can make this decision. Now, here are the skills and the talents that this woman, that my guess it was about 10 days old, okay? But she was an adult woman, and she was very cognitive and could communicate and this type of thing. And so here are her skills. She has the power of sight. She has the sense of smell. She can taste things. She can touch things. She can hear things. She has all these empirical senses that she can use to navigate this world. But absent of the tree of life, she does not have the wisdom, the virtue, the character to navigate any moral decision. And God told her this. Here is life, and here is destruction. And the reason he did this is because he knew how he made the planet. So he gave them the formula. You go here, and everything good happens. You go here, everything bad is going to happen. The reason is because you are not built to navigate that path. Did you know that, brethren? Mankind does not have the moral equipment to navigate his spiritual path. The scriptures shout this out. There is a way that seems right to man, but the ends thereof are the ways of death. It didn't say there are ways that look stupid to man and he tries to avoid them so he won't die. No, they look right to him. And so they keep seeking that fruit because it appeals to what? Sight, sound, scent, taste, touch. All these empirical skills. Now, he also thinks he's pretty smart, and so did Eve. You know, when Eve ate of that tree of the knowledge of good and evil, you know what it said? It said she saw that it was pleasant to the eye. I'm going to use my empirical senses. And my guess is it probably looked really nice. It was not some dilapidated, rotten, rancid-looking piece of fruit that nobody would be, would appeal to nobody. And it goes on, and it's desired to make one wise. It appeals to the ego. All of these things were the driving forces that compelled Eve to take this and then ultimately give it to her husband. And he did take it and did eat of it. And God knew man never had the equipment, the moral equipment to do this. Man does not have the virtue that can navigate his moral path. And the scriptures scream this out. King David once said, who can understand his own error? That's a great question. It's a rhetorical question, by the way. You know, if David was in a class and said, who can understand his own error? You know, and Ham went, oh yeah, I know the answer, I know this. It's rhetorical, chief. Nobody can understand their own error. That's why we make so many errors. We are so prone to messing up because we cannot grasp virtue and morality with the equipment we have. I got news for you. We weren't made to do it. Absent of God's wisdom and His virtue and His Spirit, we have no chance. We will not even accidentally stumble across righteousness. It is not in us. The great prophet Jeremiah, in the 10th chapter of his book, he said something that I think is just unbelievably profound. He says, I know that it is not in man that walks to direct his own steps. And what Jeremiah was saying was, these are his moral paths. I'm not talking about his motor skills. Yes, he can walk down the street, but can he direct his moral life? No, he cannot. Jesus once said to people, he says, you being evil know how to give good gifts. He didn't say you being good know how to give good gifts. And mind you, he didn't say you doing good. Okay? He said evil was a state you were in. He said you being evil. It is a state of being. It is a constant condition that man is. But can man do some things that are pretty good? Yes. Can he construct relief efforts? Yes. Is that a good thing to do? Yes. Is it a decent thing to contribute to? Yes, it is. But does this make man a good person? Man is not good. And absent of the Father, man is a mess. He will never, ever, ever be able to navigate his moral life. He will never craft a government that will work. He will never forge laws or design laws that will ever work. You can't do it. I just want you to just think about this for a second. It just came to me. We know God's holy days. We know what they picture and, you know, and what they express. If man was given 100,000 years of life, and just got to, you know, select his festivals and things like this, do you think he would ever create anything like God's seven annual holy days? Just by accident, just stumble across something like this. I mean, when you look at what he's done, we've got Christmas, we have Easter, we've got, you know, all kinds, just a host of festivals, and what mankind has done today, including professing Christians, they have called God's holy days and his Sabbath burdensome. It is a burden not to be done. God's law is burdensome. You know what the real laugh in something like this is? That when God first gave the Ten Commandments, as a matter of fact, go to Exodus 20. And now he is giving this code, this great moral code, that he's going to restore to his people, the children of Israel. And so now God is telling Moses, I want you to speak to the children of Israel about this burdensome, horrible, oppressive, lousy law that is just designed to wreck your life. And what is the first thing God says when he does this? He says to speak unto the children of Israel, and he introduces himself. I am the Lord your God, which has brought you out of the house of bondage. This is what he did. I am the liberator, okay, that delivered you from Israel. My law is not the law of bondage. It is the law that frees you. You used to be in bondage. But I have come and given you this great law. And this law is so extraordinary that if you follow it, all the nations of the earth will turn and look at you. They will admire you because you obey me. Here's the promise I make to you. If you obey my voice, your friends will respect you, your enemies will fear you, and your God will love you. All this in exchange for one small thing. Obey my voice. Go to Deuteronomy, if you would. Go to Deuteronomy, and we'll go to... These are very popular scriptures. Okay, and in verse 5, and here is Moses talking to the children of Israel and kind of conveying a message from God. And here's what he says. He's given these great laws, and they were about to go into the land of Canaan, this promised land. And now God is giving them some tips. Essentially, this is what you can do. And here's what Moses writes. He says, behold, I have taught you statutes and judgments, even as the Lord my God commanded me, that you should do so in the land whither you go to possess it. Keep therefore and do them, for this is your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the nations. So they are now going to watch, which shall hear all these statutes and say, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. For what nation is there so great who has God so nigh unto them as the Lord our God is in all things that we call upon him for? And what Moses was saying, conveying through God, the world will look at you if you obey me, and all they will see is a nation that is flooded with blessings. They will be protected. Their crops will thrive and flourish. You will be the wealthiest nation on the earth. Technology will not be beyond you. I will inspire your creative instincts. Everything you do will turn out right. That's what I'll do. If it was a crap game, you'll roll the dice. They'll always be seven. If I'm here, I will make everything in your lives right. If you will obey my voice. It sounded like a great proposition. Imagine if a country today, some third world country, decided that collectively the entire nation would kneel down, confess their sins to God, repent and say, take over our country, take over our lives, do what we want. You think God would be blind to this nation? All of a sudden, America would not be the great superpower. They would be the great superpower. This is the promise that he made. And what we see being played out in the world today is a failure of a country that thinks that all their greatness was the result of their own uniqueness and ingenuity and talents. You know what we use for intelligence to deal with terrorists? You know, I used to think, oh, it's the intelligence community. Yeah, we're gathering intelligence. I thought, well, man, there's sophisticated computers and all this kind of stuff. You know what intelligence is? It's bribing people to think on other people. This is all it is. We just keep throwing enough money and we'll find somebody that'll go, wow, 25 billion or 25 million, excuse me, to capture this guy. Write the check. Here, he's right over here. But nobody does it. And here what God is saying is, I know you think your intelligence is good, but let me give you a couple of my credentials. When 19 fanatics got on board four airlines, preparing to crash them into buildings and into, you know, countrysides in southern Pennsylvania, I knew every one of their thoughts. And I was perfectly capable, if you turn to me, I was perfectly capable of giving them dysentery before they got on the plane. They'd head to the bathroom, puke, do anything they could do to try to deal with it. I didn't need to bribe anybody. If you turn to me and say, you give us your wisdom and you protect our nation, and this is what we do, he has promised it. And you literally can call on that promise. And God periodically actually interjects himself into human affairs and says, do you want me to help? I can really do this. I'm going to give you an example of that. Go to 2 Chronicles. Chapter 7, 2 Chronicles chapter 7. And God could say this to the nation right now. He could utter it to the United States, and I believe he does. Okay, in other words, I think what he is saying here is, United States, you turn, you repent, and we'll, bygones are the bygones. I will return to you. I will embrace you. You will be my people, and I will be your God. I guarantee it. I have not given up on you. I know you now have given up on me. I appeal to you to turn. And here's what he says. Chapter 7, verse 14. He says, if my people, which are called by my name, shall humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven and I will forgive their sin and I will heal their land. I am perfectly capable of making all the nonsense that has just smothered this earth right. But I'm not a fool, and I'm no genie in a lamp. You don't get to rub and summon me like some, you know, servant in your life and say, I want you to correct this, but don't ask for anything from me. God has at least as much common sense and wisdom as we do. Okay, I speak facetiously. Okay, he is the great, perfect moral voice. You don't mock God. If you want his blessings, the infinite blessings that he can bestow upon you, here's how to do it. He never changed the formula. Here's the formula. Do it. You know, so somebody says, well, God, there's just disaster everywhere and people are dying in the Middle East and people are getting just destroyed in our country and our lives are just messed up. Why don't you do something? Oh, really? Okay, let me show you how to do it. We'll siphon the chocolate milk out of the car and we'll put gasoline in it. I don't want to do that. Just make the car run. But I didn't make the car to run like that. I didn't make the world to run in a way that would validate your evil. I'm not an idiot. You do this. You concoct laws where people can do horrible things in their lives, and you can say, well, no problem, you know, we'll let him go. We want to understand them and be more tolerant of them and this type of thing. That's your justice. You're a type of people that will say, we are going to make God believe that two of the same sex can get married, and somehow it is just as moral, just as right as a male and a female. And they contort the scriptures to say, God really wants us to do it. What he's really interested is really us just loving each other. Here's what Jesus Christ said. Have you not read that he which made them from the beginning made them male and female? Why? For this purpose shall a man leave his father and mother and cleave unto himself a wife. That's why. This was the purpose of this. It created this union. Now the union itself had a much greater purpose. It pictured the relationship between Christ and the church. It's a spiritual institution with profound significance in what man has done in his own self-righteous attempt to show that he's really more moral than God, is to say, everything is right if it feels right to you. And this is how we do things. This is how we govern our lives. So God says, I got to correct a little bit of behavior. Who are you to correct me? I'm the moral authority. I'll do what's right in my own eyes. By the way, why didn't you heal this land, you know, prevent this tsunami from coming? Brethren, that is the story of this human experience. It has played out for generation after generation after generation after generation of man saying, I want to have control. I can fix this. I can do it. And no matter how hard man tries, he's just the kid in the living room with the hammer busting everything up in the house. And God says, if you want to do this. However, here is the good news. It will not always be that way. There is a time that is going to come when all people will know God. If you read the book of Ezekiel, it says repeatedly, and all shall know that I am the Eternal. We sang a song about Zechariah 14, and it says all nations will obey. There is a time when Jesus Christ is going to come to this earth, restore great order to this earth. And a country that thinks they have been empowered by sin are really going to experience true liberty. They're going to be introduced to God's law. And all the suffering that they go through now, they're going to learn, man, I never could have done it. You set this thing before me, the formula for health and hope and happiness and success and a vibrant life, and I shunned it and took my own path and just created immeasurable heartache. Brethren, it is interesting. Here's something to think about. When you read about the new heavens and the new earth, it talks about a tree in the midst of the city, this new Jerusalem. You know what the tree is? It's the tree of life. You know what is not there? The tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And it's my personal belief that it was man that ultimately destroyed the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Man told God, we have learned this lesson. We don't want this. We reject this. We destroy it. We want to burn it. We want to kill it because it has wreaked havoc. Our own moral self-will will never result to happiness. You are the great moral authority. We trust in you and we lean not to our own understanding. I think that is ultimately going to take place, and it is a time when the entire creation, all mankind, is going to know this wonderful truth, and everything will be different. Brethren, I am going to conclude by reading you a story. And I think it's kind of an interesting story, and by the way, the person that wrote us this letter, we responded with, in part, with this story. Just to illustrate what it is we think is really going on. And we told him, we don't think it is God that didn't want to help. We think it's man that really didn't want him to help. Oh yeah, they cry out to him, but they won't do what he says. It's like going to a doctor, and the doctor says, well, you have to start, you know, change your diet and exercise and all of this. And the patient says, well, that's nonsense. You know, I like, you know, carousing and eating all the bad stuff and sitting on the couch with the remote control. There's my exercise. I can do that. I'm a very talented guy. Okay. When my wife's there, you know, she knows this is the sacred piece of furniture. Only thing in the house belongs to me. Get your hands off my sacred piece of furniture. Okay. I mean, you know how this is. But we responded to this and told him that we believe and we are absolutely convinced, not sort of, not theoretically, not some theological mumbo-jumbo, that man can access God's great power, His great love, His great wisdom, and His ability to govern nature. Jesus Christ's apostles screamed out, "We're going to go overboard!" Jesus stood up and said, "Peace, be still, storm goes down." Okay? Wow, that was pretty good. Now you think, if Jesus Christ was called upon in Southeast Asia with this earthquake has now erupted, and by the way, do you know how fast the current was taking this wave to the mainland of Indonesia? It was traveling at 500 miles an hour. Can you believe that? The water was just ripping underneath it, and as it approached the mainland, it stopped. It just skidded, and this big wave comes up behind it based on inertia or momentum, and it literally just kept carrying this 30-foot-high wave a mile inland. And then 5 minutes later, the next wave comes in. And between every 5 and 40 minutes, they said between 5 and 40 minutes, this steady stream of absolute wreckage comes in and just destroys lives. I mean, when you see pictures, and I think many of you have seen them, it just looks like a nuclear bomb had gone off in it. It is just absolutely devastating. Now imagine Jesus Christ. Do you think if Jesus Christ sees this coming and He says, "Peace, be still," you think it's not going to stop? He had the power over the forces of nature. He still does now. Peace, be still. No tsunami. Enjoy your day at the beach. And if you will incline yourself to His voice, obey My voice, I will be the one that delivers you. I am the great deliverer. He told Nineveh through the prophet Jonah. He appealed to them. Don't do what you do or you will die. Nineveh remarkably repented and they were spared. Jonah actually said, "I knew that you were a merciful God. I just knew you were going to do this." Because it repents you of the evil. And by the way, when it says repent you of the evil, it actually means evil. The Hebrew word is ra. It means calamity. You don't want calamity. You don't want to bring destruction on land, on nations. We know what you want. You want peace, prosperity, health, hope, children playing in the streets, you know, dancing, peace everywhere, everything going right. A vibrant life where everybody has their own home, sits under their own fig tree. It is just it's a magical place. That's what you want. And it's going to come to this earth. And the reason it is going to work is because it's going to be presided over by a perfect God with perfect virtue. And He's going to say, "Listen, I know something about this. Try this." And it will work. Here is the story that we finished the letter to this gentleman, and I would like to read it to you. I call the story now, it's different on our website, but I call the story The Apprentice. Everybody who watches has probably seen this program, The Apprentice, and this is a story about an apprentice. There once was a great master carpenter who specialized in making exquisite furniture. His skill was legendary and his services were sought all over the globe. As you looked at his work, you could see the love and patience he put into it. Every piece was absolutely flawless. This great artisan spent decades perfecting his craft, and his dedication rewarded him with a skill that was unmatched in all the world. One day, this great master asked his young apprentice if he would like to complete a very important project. His student was thrilled and readily accepted the invitation. However, before he could start, his teacher informed him that to succeed in this project, he would have to diligently follow very specific instructions. There could not be the slightest deviation from the specifications his teacher had laid out. The master even warned his pupil that any alteration or deviation from his instructions would result in failure. As the young apprentice began his work, he was mindful of his teacher's words. He painstakingly memorized all the notes and plans. He would also constantly review the many drawings of this wonderful piece of furniture. However, as the days turned into weeks, the young man became frustrated at how difficult the task had become. At this point, he decided to make some slight modifications to the plan. Unfortunately, each modification only served to compromise the project. When his master sought to help, The young man became angry and insisted that he could do it on his own. Can you imagine this? No. I can fix this. However, in the end, what started out to be a great masterpiece was ruined. Ruined because the young apprentice thought his skill, that was in its infant stages, could accomplish what his master had acquired over several decades. Although this great master had every right to be angry with his pupil, he was more interested in knowing what his apprentice had learned. When he sought the answer to this query, the student told him, and my guess is he was very quiet and sheepish and embarrassed and this type of thing. But he saw what had transpired over the course of this project. And finally, the student confesses, I have learned to trust you and to lean not to my own understanding. When the master heard these words, he embraced his pupil and said, what you have gained in failure is worth more than anything made with hands. I rejoice in your success. I do so because now you are ready to be the master. Now, the story of this master craftsman is very touching, okay? But it is similar to one that has already played out in the world today and is continuing to play out in our world. Only this time, God is the master and you are the pupil. With this in mind, imagine what you would do if God gave you a chance to determine the destiny of the world. Now, there is an awesome task. What would you do? Would you accept this invitation? And what would you do to the world? Would you be willing to build its governments, to craft its laws, to define its values, and to inspire its faiths? Now imagine that when God extended this invitation, he also informed you that he had already crafted a formula for total success in this endeavor. This formula was guaranteed to bring happiness to the human experience. He now presents you with a choice. You may allow God to be your guide on this quest, or you may forge the path on your own. At this point, God cautions you to carefully consider your options. He then warns you that only his way will succeed. Furthermore, he explains that your way will only lead to destruction. This is the same choice God presented to the first human family nearly 6,000 years ago. Unfortunately, Adam and Eve thought they could manage this world without the aid of their Creator. It sounds unbelievable, but it is true. As a result of mankind doing this, he continues to walk a path that is only paved with misery. In the wake of this decision, this decision that said, I can do it on my own, governments continue to topple. Laws continue to be mocked. Values continue to degenerate, while natural disasters continue to accelerate. Mind you, it did not have to be this way. God said, if you will repent, turn to me, I will heal your land. I created this land. I can heal it. The man asked, where was God? Here's the answer. Where was God when the horrible tragedy that swept Southern Asia took place? The answer to this question may be too simple to believe. The great God of the universe was right where he has always been, in the third heaven where his will is only continued and performed every day. In that kingdom, there is only peace and abundance. The real question is, where were we? And why have we been persuaded to reject our only hope and, in essence, go it alone? That route has been traveled before from generation to generation to generation to generation to generation to generation to this current generation. And its streets are only paved with misery. Furthermore, the reason God allows horrible events like that of a catastrophic killer inflicting its will on millions of lives is the same reason he allows so many other tragedies. He does so because he wants man to know what the world would look like without him as its guiding moral presence. This is not God's world. Man decided he did not need God's wisdom and virtue while living in a garden some 6,000 years ago. There man decided to determine for himself what was good and what was evil. And he continues to assert that right to this very day. As a result of man's judgment, and this is the answer, as the result of man's judgment, the innocent will always suffer. There will always be poverty. Families will be ripped apart by divorce. Ignorance and superstition will corrupt man's great potential. Justice will be perverted. Terrorists will kill at random. Children will be molested by people they trust. Sickness and disease will attack the weak. Tyrants will rule the earth, and great natural disasters will continue to wreak havoc and ravage the planet. Here is the good news. However, if you believe the story in God's Word, as he weaves this extraordinary destiny for man, there is a happy ending. Mankind will eventually understand this wonderful truth. He will then be able to make sense out of the tragedy that not God inflicted, that he inflicted. And when that day comes, the great God of heaven, this great master architect and loving father, the architect of all things, will declare to his human family, what you have gained in failure is worth far more than anything made with hands. I rejoice in your success. I do so because now you are ready to be the master.